있는.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to session 1D, the appointed actuary in general insurance, a stakeholder assessment of the regime. My name's David Goodsall. I've got the pleasure of chairing this session today. I'm very interested to see how it goes. I've held 13 life insurance appointed actuary roles, so I know it well from that side. I'm looking forward to seeing what's happening in the general insurance area today. And I know that the panel here are looking forward to comments from both from all areas, general insurance, life insurance and health insurance, and we have a representation across the board, which is excellent. Today's session is a presentation of the results of a survey conducted by the Appointed Actuary Working Group set up under the General Insurance Practice Committee. The survey covered the many stakeholders involved in dealing with the Appointed Actuary regime, and it's today presented by two representatives of that working group, not Chris Latham as advertised, who is not well. So today we have, in alphabetical order, Susan Lay. Susan has over 14 years' experience in general insurance in both the UK and Australia, both within industry and as a consultant working with an audit firm. And she has held appointed actuary roles and been a peer reviewer, so very practical experience. And actually, as her CV had her interests, which were speleology, dog agility, and quilting. And I thought that's a wonderful example of risk management, because when when there's a cave in and she's trapped, her dogs can come in and rescue her. But while she's waiting, she's got something to do. Melissa has been in financial services for around 15 years or so, and 9 years in general insurance. And she also has a wide experience both in industry and through the consulting and audit firms, and also has held appointed actuary and peer review roles, so very experienced people. So on that, I'd like to hand over to Melissa's going up first. And we'll be looking for a lot of participation following the end of the presentation, so we'll look forward to that. Thank you, Melissa.
Okay, good morning, everyone. I try not to go into a coughing fit. If so, apologies. Before we start, I thought it would be good to set the agenda for this presentation. The agenda is basically giving you a background in terms of the assessment, why we do it and how we actually go about it. And then we'll present the results in terms from into three sections. Firstly, we go through the viewpoints from the actuary, the appointed actuary, as well as the reviewing actuary. The reviewing actuary, for those who are not actually in the GI background, the reviewing actuary is the actuary who does the external peer review on the appointed actuary. And as well as the relationship between the appointed actuary as well as the reviewing actuary. Then we go into the user views on users being the non-actuaries, the management, the board, and APRA. Their views on the three reports, which is produced part of the regulatory regime. And there is the LVR, the Insurance Liability Evaluation Report, the EPR, which is the External Peer Review Report, and the FCR, which is the Financial Condition Report. We then wrap up with comments from APRA, as well as any key observations from this survey. For the general insurance space, the pool of actuary, or what we call the appointed actuary, was first introduced in July 2002. Subsequent to that, APRA put in further requirements for additional review, which is the external peer review, the EPR, and the financial requirement for the financial condition report in 2006. When we did the survey, which is back in 2008, and it's 2 years down the track where we have introduced external peer review and financial condition report, and we thought it was a good time to reflect back on how effective those regulatory regime is and what are people's views on that regime, and particularly on their views on the FCR, which has quite a controversial views when it was first floated. So the objective is basically to get the views of all stakeholders on how the regulatory regime is working, but more importantly, try to identify the best practice and any current barriers so that we can actually optimise the value of our profession and how we can actually add value. So how do we actually go about it? We decided on doing a survey, and a survey is basically a web-based survey with the help of Institute of Actuaries of Australia. We know that we have to survey all the key stakeholders of the regime, basically the appointed actuary, the reviewing actuary, the appointed auditors, the management, the board, and finally comments from APRA. With each of the survey, each of the stakeholders have a different survey, but within each of the survey, we have common questions being asked, so we can actually get different perspectives on certain of the topics. All the surveys are anonymous. Institute of Actuaries will send out those surveys, and when it should return to us, when the results are actually returned to the working party, the name and the company has been stripped out, so we don't know where they're from and who are they from. To just give you a few who we actually survey, when we send out invites for the survey, we try to capture insurers which vary by size. We have internal actuaries and external actuaries which write different class of business. So all in all, we sort of survey 21 insurers. Moving on to the results. Firstly, we go through the appointed actuary results. We have surveyed the appointed actuary on a number of topics, mainly on the ILVR, EPR, and FCR. Given that FCR was more controversial and we have a lot more comments as a result, this presentation is mainly focusing on the comments we received from FCR and less so on the ILVR and EPR. We asked questions to the AA in terms of the process, the timing, how they actually go about with the evaluation, the interactions of different parties so they actually come up with the ILVR. A positive feedback is that there is no really specific issues being raised. Another positive feedback is that 90% of them find that there's sufficient time to actually produce the ILVR. Only 10% thinks that they don't have enough time to do that. With respect to the external EPR, peer review, it's no surprise that there will be difference in opinions between actuaries. A third of them reported there are differences in opinion, but more importantly, all the differences are being resolved before the final ILVR is being produced, and generally they are being raised very early and there will be discussions between the AA and RA to resolve them. As for the effectiveness of the EPR, most of them find the process quite positive, and they see it as a means of improving their evaluation reporting quality. There is no significant changes to the numbers, but they would make minor changes. Okay, now is the financial condition report. We asked the AA in terms of what process they actually go through to write their financial condition report, given that it does cover a range of topics which is not necessary insurance liabilities. And the AA met with a wide range of people, namely the underwriting claims CFO, and generally the people are very open and receptive to the queries being made by the AA. And the AA also got help from the non-actuaries and management in writing certain topics which is not their expertise, being the business overview, investments, reinsurance, and risk management. And it's also no surprise that they find the risk management is the hardest section to write, which is really outside the comfort zone for the first time around. And some of the AA actually opted out by means of having the help of risk management experts, but others actually do it themselves by using a first principle basis, being asking the question, review, document, and make recommendations. We asked the AA in terms of whether they have actually made recommendations, the nature of the recommendations, how the recommendations are being perceived, and whether they actually act upon them. About one quarter of the responses says that they actually make no recommendations, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they make no suggestion for improvement. For those who actually make recommendations, they noted that there's no significant resistance to having making that recommendations, but they also noted that they have to deal with it very carefully in terms of carefully worded and need to be sensitively communicated to the board, and in some cases the wordings of the recommendations need to be reworded before you actually finalise the financial condition report. In terms of whether those recommendations are being acted upon on, only 42% of the AE reported that some of the recommendations are being acted upon on. So it sort of reflects that the management might not necessarily view the recommendations from the actuary is a must to do on their list. In terms of how the FCR is being delivered, three quarters actually present to the board, which is quite positive, having this face-to-face interaction and discussion with the board. And when they actually present it, they normally have very favourable feedback. And also three quarters give their FCR to the auditors. We then asked the AA in terms of how do they perceive the value of their financial condition report. We asked the same question for the second FCR, because by the time we actually did the assessment, most of the companies will have written their second FCR or on the way of writing the third FCR. With respect to the first FCR, more than 75% thinks that they provide very good or moderate value. Only 20% thinks that it's more of a compliance document. We asked the same question on the second FCR, and there's no difference in responses. We then asked them what is the best and the worst aspects of preparing the FCR. FCR being a wide-ranging document, it's no surprise that they think that best aspects are actually broadening their understanding and involvement of the insurance operations, giving them a more holistic view of the insurance operations. And it also helps when they actually have positive feedback from the management in terms of the document. And the worst aspects of it, it's having to write on topics which is really outside the comfort zone or expertise, mainly the risk management operations. And it's also the timing of the SL, which is at the year end, which is giving them an additional thing to do besides insurance liabilities. And some of them do experience some time pressure in producing this document. We then move on to the viewing actuary viewpoint. The EPR process do have some overlap in terms of the audit assistance. So we asked them how many of them actually provide audit assistance as well. And 68% says they provide audit assistance, but of course the EPR process is slightly different. There's overlap, but the EPR scope is actually wider because it does have specific requirements to abide by being the PS100. And it's more concentrated on the process of attaining the numbers besides the end results, and the report actually goes to a broader range of recipients. We then asked them when they actually get involved into the external peer review process, and 42% says they actually get involved before the results are being issued. This sort of highlights that the EPR is actually is concentrated on the evaluation process rather than results, and 32% says it actually comes in when the draft report is being issued. We then asked them in terms of how they actually go about in ascertaining the reasonableness of the primary estimates. All but one reviewed the report. Not sure what the one the outlier actually does. All of them do high-level checks. 43% do some sort of reprojections. One did all reprojections, and nobody actually produced alternative estimates. I guess this sort of highlights that the focus is actually checking the reasonableness of the primary estimates rather than coming up with an alternative number, which is what the EPR is all about. Most of the time, the ILVR doesn't provide enough information for us to actually write the EPR report. Additional information is generally required. We ask them how they actually ascertain those additional information. Generally, what they do is a face-to-face discussion with the AA. others is all getting additional information via email. In terms of differences in opinion, the views is the same as what the views from the AA is, that generally there will be differences in editorial opinion, but the thing is that they generally get involved, resolve prior to the final LVR, and there will be two-way discussion between different parties. We then ask what is the best, similar to the AA, we ask them what's the best aspects and the hardest part of preparing the EPR report. To them, providing feedback in terms of ideas for improvement to the evaluation approach and processes, as well as getting positive feedback from the board and audit committee, and as well as the interaction with the AA in terms of sharing ideas and exchanging information. The hardest bit is actually because EPR is only done once a year, so the hardest part is actually coming in at the end of the year, grasping the nuances of each portfolio at the end of the year within the limit timeline, as well as trying to catch up what's happened over the year since the last previous review. It doesn't really help when they're not seen to be adding value, as well as when they are time pressures, because EPR report is depending on the delivery of the ILVR. If the ILVR is late, that doesn't mean that delivery date to the audit committee would move, so there will be more time pressure if it's late. I'll then hand over to Susan to talk about the user's viewpoint of the various reports.
Thanks, Melissa. Well, so far we've heard what the responses were from the appointed actuaries and the reviewing actuaries. Now we're going to look at the non-actuarial users of the various reports. So we're talking here about management, the board, and auditors. We asked a question about data in the valuation. Specifically, how did actuaries go about ensuring data integrity? And we asked the other users a few questions about data as well. With the appointed actuaries, most of them used a variety of methods to ensure the integrity of the data. Everybody effectively did reconciliations, and most people did some internal reconciliation as well. So most people validated the data back to at least a ledger. Auditors said that about three quarters of them had been told what data the appointed actuary needed and what checks they'd like done and what data is important. However, only 9% of auditors thought that it was their responsibility for data integrity. 73% thought it was the company. So this is an area where there needs to be very good, clear communication between the appointed actuary and the appointed auditor about who is doing what and who is responsible for what. The next question we asked was about how user-friendly the report was to the different groups. As you can see, the auditors found it all very or reasonably useful, and the reviewing actuaries were those who found the least use out of the report, but even there, 75% found the report was either very or reasonably useful. And we think this just reflects the different uses that people put the report to. If you're a reviewing actuary, as Melissa's already alluded to, it's entirely possible that the report doesn't contain all the information that you need to carry out your external peer review. In terms of presenting to the board, how useful did the board find a presentation on the valuations? Well, as you can see, a significant proportion found it reasonably or very useful, which was pleasing. It's probably a bit of a concern that we have 20% who found it not at all useful. It does indicate that there's an area there for improvement. We're moving on to EPRs. What were the users' viewpoints of the EPR? Well, there was generally positive feedback about the process. The majority of appointed actuaries and reviewing actuaries found that the EPR process was constructive. It wasn't competitive. They found there was generally sufficient time to forward their views, and there was sufficient time to discuss any issues raised in advance of deadlines. It was generally a collaborative approach, and a lot of actuaries noted that there was a lot of sharing of information and best practice. And each also said that they found the other's report reasonably useful. We did, however, have some suggestions for improvement. We had comments that the EPR report was too long, it was too micro-focused, and too process-oriented, so all about process rather than adding value. There's also the point raised that valid differences in professional opinion do not necessarily need to be resolved. And this is probably an area where we should all bear in mind that PS 100 says it's all about whether the whether the actuary's report and results are reasonable rather than what we do. There was also, quite commonly, a feeling of overkill, that EPRs weren't necessarily required as frequently for all companies. And there was one suggestion that it may only be required where there isn't a strong internal peer review culture within an insurer. So we move on to who considered the EPR useful. Auditors found it very useful. Again, this ties in with having a significant proportion of the reviewing actuaries also working for auditors. Management found it less so, and the board, three quarters of the board members who replied, found it useful. We wonder whether management's response is because they're not necessarily aware of the full extent of the interaction between the reviewing actuary and the appointed actuary. So maybe there's a lot going on behind the scenes that they're not that aware of. We move on to the FCR. Again, we have more to say about this than the ILVR and the EPR. Essentially, all board members, management and the auditors responding said that they had read the FCR, so they do find it a useful document. Three quarters of board members said that they found the presentation of the FCR very useful or reasonably useful. It's interesting, though, we asked a question of management about how useful they thought board members would find it, and only 65% of them thought the board might have or didn't find the FCR useful. So we're getting a conflicting view here. Board members said they did find it useful. Management, on the other hand, had the perception that they didn't. About 80% of management said that they thought the FCR met their expectations, but 71% commented that it was too long. One third of auditors said that they received the FCR after the audit sign-off. So it shows that in a significant number of cases, the FCR is probably not adding a lot of value from an auditor's point of view. We asked how useful the FCR was in managing the business. Board and management both found that it was somewhat useful, but not incredibly useful in managing the business. Auditors found it less useful in forming their opinion. But again, we think that this probably highlights the different roles the FCR plays for the different parties. The FCR is a long document. If you read Professional Standard 305 for general insurance actuaries, it's the list of the sections that need to be included. There are quite a lot of them. So we asked the board and management which sections they found most useful. And not surprisingly, management and the board actually found similar sections useful. Generally, they found sections where the actuary had a regular involvement, the valuation section, talking about past experience, pricing, capital adequacy, they found those sections were the most useful. Less useful to board and management were those sections where the actuary doesn't generally have a day-to-day involvement, such as risk management and investments, areas where this may be the first time the actuary has become involved. Now, we had a comment earlier on that 71% of management thought that the FCR was too long. We had actually in our survey asked a question about how long the FCRs were. And what you can see from this is about 80% of them were between 26 and 100 pages long. To put that in context, we did survey a number of companies, big and small. Some of them wrote a significant number of lines of business, others very few lines of business. So we believe that this result is probably what we were expecting, because the size and complexity of a company and its business will influence how large the FCR needs to be to adequately do its job. We had some suggestions for improvements from the survey participants. These included shorter, more focused, less waffle. We had the request for more emphasis on the business implications. A number of management and board noted that the recommendations are not always commercially practical, an indication that we need to be less theoretical and put our business hats on and be business focused. We also had a comment that it would be good to include a provision for management's responses to the recommendations. The time frame often means that management get the FCR fairly close to the board meeting at which it's presented, so there's little opportunity for them to actually respond to the recommendations. And that gave rise to the final suggestion, that it would be useful to extend the time frame to give a bit more time to examine the results. We next go to some verbatim comments that we actually got, and these were very varied. As you can see, the first ones were along the lines of waste of time, skip it completely. And we had the full range of responses through to it's the most important and valuable document that directors and management could possibly read, no suggestions for improvement. So as you can see, a wide range of views. Well, obviously we didn't survey APRA, and APRA are very interested in all these, seeing how their regime's gone. Once the results came back, we interviewed a couple of people from APRA, and our thanks to them for helping out. And we focused, in the end, mainly on the SCRs, but we got some comments about the other ones as well. So the first area that we had questions about was the quality of the reports. And we asked APRA about the overall quality of the reports. This encompassed EPRs, ILVRs and SCRs. And we got the comment back from APRA that they found there was less variation in quality of ILVRs compared to SCRs. They put this down to the fact that the ILVRs have been around now since 2002, whereas the SCRs, at the time of doing this survey, had only been through the process twice. So they're still being bedded down. We thought that the size of the insurer might also impact on the quality of the SCR, on the grounds that a larger insurer might have more resources available to use to develop and write the SCR. APRA basically came back and said, no, the size has had little impact on the quality. Another area we thought might affect the quality was whether it was an internal or an external appointed actuary. Again, APRA said no. It really didn't make much difference. The main determinant of quality was the individual appointed actuary. The other interesting insight that APRA provided was that EPR reports were often not very insightful. So that represents an area where actuaries could definitely improve, and a bit more on that later. So some general comments about FCRs. APRA said they were better than they originally expected. Now, to put that in context, when the idea of the FCR was first floated, actuaries, general insurance actuaries, often put up their hands in horror and said, we know nothing about this, we can't write all these sections. So APRA was pleasantly surprised when they got the first round of SCRs in, and they found that actuaries had coped a lot better than they originally were worried about. But interestingly, APRA said the pricing section was often one of the weakest sections in the report. That's an area where you'd probably think that actuaries would be likely to have more involvement. Another thing that came across was that APRA see the SCR as a key tool. When they're going to look at a company, they find that the SCR is a valuable first port of call to give them an indication of what's happening in the company and a good overview of the company. And again, as we noted before, no linkage between the size of company and the depth of the SCR. We asked APRA if they had any general comments overall about SCRs and other reports. And the comment we got back, lovely quote, be courageous. They often thought that appointed actuaries were not as bold as they could be, or possibly as they should be, in their reports. And they gained a lot more comfort where the appointed actuary challenged assumptions, even if it's only their own assumptions, and where they could see evidence in the report that the actuary wasn't taking everything they'd been given on face value, but they were investigating and challenging. They found that gave them more comfort that there was a robust process involved. Now just going on to summarise the individual viewpoints for you. Quick recap. Appointed actuary. Comments on the current environment. A number of them are questioning the value of the EPR. They're concerned there's too much compliance, too much focus on process, and not enough value adding. They also asked, how's APRA actually using the SCRs? Because there hasn't been much feedback on this. There was also a request for help from the Institute of Actuaries and APRA to get more feedback on SCRs. Often the actuaries preparing SCRs won't see any other SCRs. So it's hard to get a feel for what best practice is, where the pitfalls are. They'd like some way of benchmarking their reports and getting a picture of what a typical good best practice SCR looks like. They also asked for assistance on risk margins. And some of that has been forthcoming from the risk margins working group. But I suspect that there's still a requirement for more, especially for smaller companies. From the reviewing actuary's viewpoint, they had mixed views on the value of the EPR. and they were seriously questioning the frequency of the EPR. They thought it would be better if it was more dependent on solvency coverage, economic cycle, or insurance cycle. In other words, maybe not an EPR for every company every year. Reviewing actuaries too were after help from the Institute and APRA. They were after more guidance on controls and auditing at source. What constitutes best practice? What should they be looking for? What should they be seeing? And also more guidance on the materiality definition. And again, they said they'd like more feedback from APRA. And given the comment we had from APRA, it sounds like it would be mutually beneficial to have a two-way conversation going on about that. In terms of general comments from the other users about the ILVR, the board basically were crying out for more explanation in business terms for the movements. Management in general positively felt the valuation report was reasonably or very relevant to them, which is a good thing. But they said the key points were often buried, need better executive summaries. Again, an indication that we need to lift our game in terms of our reports. There were no particular common threads from the auditors. Just a quick refresh of the objectives. We were aiming to obtain the views of all the stakeholders of how the regime's working, and we wanted to try and identify some best practice and any current barriers to how we can optimise the value of our profession in this regime. In terms of the key observations, well, appointed actuaries are coping okay, even with the FCR, but they would like some help from APRA and the Institute. And there are doubts about how much value adding is being carried out with the EPR. In terms of the users, they generally find all reports useful or helpful, but there's room for improvement, especially around putting things in business terms and making recommendations clear. And we also had some differing views on how useful FCRs are. Again, that indicates an area where we can improve. The working group, however, looked at these comments, especially about EPRs, and wondered whether, under different economic conditions, we might be seeing different commentary. We've just come off a period of very good profitability in most lines for most insurers. We wondered whether if we'd been coming off a period when profitability had been down, whether actually internal actuaries or appointed actuaries might find having an EPR useful in terms of being able to stand up to management to get sensible assumptions through, and whether it would help remove some of the pressure on them. In terms of best practice, the overwhelming feedback coming back from the users is draw out key observations and reports. Think of the reports from the users' viewpoints. We need to make sure we use their terminology, express it in their terms, and make it easy for them to understand what we've done and the value we've added. Also, the best reports are those where the actuary is fearless, where they bring out the difficult points they're not afraid to, and where they ask the hard questions. Finally, I'd just like to say a big thank you to everyone who helped out. So that's all the appointed actuaries, reviewing actuaries, auditors, management, board, and APRA. And as you can see, we're only two of the working group, so also thanks to our fellow members. Now, just before we move on to the discussion, could I get a show of hands? Who works in predominantly in general insurance? Health insurance? Life insurance? Okay, well, hopefully we can get some feedback from all sides on the general insurance actuaries, whether they agree with this, life insurance and health insurance, whether what we've seen is similar to what they've seen in their field. Thank you.
Thanks, Susan. In terms of discussion, it's very important that you go up to the microphone to speak and if you'd let us know who you are, because it is recorded and it forms part of CPD. So while I speak, if anybody wants to stand up and go to the microphone, that'd be great. With the discussion, I think it'd be very helpful if we focus on the value to the user. And I just pose the question or the thought, this is a regulatory-driven piece of work, the whole appointed actuary role. If that regulation were taken away, what's the value we as professionals adding which would cause the companies to keep that role going? So anybody who might like to take up that challenge would be very welcome, and we'd certainly be interested in what we can learn from the results of this, as you as practitioners think, but also from the life and health people in the audience, lessons we can learn from those regimes. I mean, the life one's been around for a long, long time. So on that, open to discussion.
Jeff Thorpe from Westpac General Insurance. You've got two comments you had up in there. One was the APRA saying be courageous, and the last comment saying they're the best when the actuary is really bold in making comments. And then you've got another one which is saying that all these sorts of things are actually discussed with the business. Is it a case of most of the things are resolved before it gets into the reports, and therefore it's not being worded as strongly as maybe APRA might like? And if you are to be courageous, is there ways of actually supporting that via the APRA regulations and stuff like that? Because, you know, there's a lot of actuaries around. Business might see it as a possibility of saying, well, if you're going to write like that, then we'll find somebody else.
Some comments?
Colin Priest, we definitely need better protection for appointed actuaries. I just lost my job in the last month because I was courageous at the prompting of APRA. And APRA are not going to protect me. The legislation may or may not protect me. I'm going to have to fork out a fortune on legal bills. But as the market turns, which it's doing now, we have to turn from writing FCRs especially that pretty much say good things to FCRs that are going to be saying more and more negative things. And my experience is that businesses don't really want that FCR. It's only there because they're forced to do it. They'd much rather have managers do that than actuaries. But certainly the Institute should be looking at lobbying APRA to give us better protections. I would encourage anyone to be courageous, but you're not going to be very well protected.
We have the comment in there that as a working group we were wondering what the impact was going to be of the EPRs in a downturn. So one hopes that to some extent the EPR process may provide some protection, certainly on the valuation side, although not the FCR side, in terms of providing support for assumptions if you do have to be courageous. So it's probably an indication that maybe with the EPR process we need to start it earlier. We had about 42% getting involved before the report. Maybe it's a case for anyone who out there who's a reviewing actuary should make sure that they have good regular contact with the appointed actuary, so that everyone's on the same page, and if the appointed actuary needs a bit of backup, they're there to give it. But yes, we probably do need a bit more assistance in terms of getting the bad message across.
Any other comments?
It's Alex Gould from PricewaterhouseCoopers. You mentioned a few times that the EPR wasn't seen as adding much value. I was just wondering whether the group had had any thoughts on what changes might be made to make it more value-adding.
I think the comment that EPR is not making much, they're adding much value, needs to be interpreted with some perspective. I think that by the time we're actually doing the survey, it's actually a second time around on the EPRs. I think much of the a lot of the web value adding is actually in the first round of the EPRs, where you actually review the actuaries' LVR for the first time, and that's where most of the improvement would have put through. Second time around, where most of the process are being bedded down, I think this is when you find it a little bit more hard to make more comments on the improvement. I guess in terms of improving the EPR, I think we need to think outside what is PS 100 requests do in terms of more on the business perspective of it. I think this is something that's food for thought and needs to be thought about.
Nathan Rivette, IAG, also on EPR. I think EPR is something very difficult to measure, I would have thought. because what you have to try and measure it against is what would happen if you didn't do it in the first place. So what would the reports be like if there was no EPR? Clearly the original valuation actuaries are going to be anticipating the EPR. And therefore, I think, Susan, you made the comment that EPR wasn't providing any significant insights and that was something that needed to be corrected. I would have thought that was a great thing. Obviously shows the original valuation work has been done adequately and there are no major issues to be found, which is what we would want, I would have thought.
The other thing with the EPR, I think, is to do with the last slide we had, is that the EPR was done in a very good in an environment where companies are making profits and investment returns are good. I think the true value of the EPR could be seen when there is actually an adverse economic cycle or insurance cycle. That's when the true value comes through.
Okay, we've run out of time, so I have to call the proceedings to a close. Thank you for attending and participating, and I'd like to join me in thanking Susan and Melissa.